Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Waisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right. We're going to go to theconversation.com that has a great piece on the two musical notes that changed Hollywood forever. Dun.
Oh.
Right? Yeah. Wow. That's the one.
That's impressive.
That's
actually
all you need.
That's all it took to get the reference, right? It not only changed Hollywood forever, but it got y'all too. And if you haven't seen Jaws, summertime is the perfect time. So 50 years ago, Steven Spielberg's blockbuster film, which many film historians now think of as the first true summer blockbuster.
Mm-hmm. Wait, I'm sorry. How many years ago?
50. Try not to do the math.
Yeah, 1975. Yep.
So this article takes a deeper dive into the staying power of these two simple musical notes and how they were also influenced by 19th century classical music, Alfred Hitchcock, and even Mickey Mouse.
Huh. Hmm.
So in 1964, a fisherman named Frank Mundus killed a 4,500-pound great white shark off Long Island.
Hmm.
Now, after hearing the story, freelance journalist Peter Benchley began pitching a novel based on three men's attempt to capture a man-eating shark, basing the character of Quint off of Mundus. Now, Doubleday commissioned Benchley to write the novel, and in 1973, Universal Studios producers Richard D. Zanuck and David Brown purchased the rights to the novel before it was published. And the 26-year-old Spielberg was signed on to be the director.
Mm.
They bought the book before the book was published?
That's right.
And it's insane simply that they commissioned the book before the book was written. Like, I have publishing experience, and I'm telling you guys, that doesn't happen. You have fully written book, and even then they're like, I don't know that I'm going to bother reading it.
But when it's 1973 and the world is going to hell in a handbasket in its own special kind of way, you need a distraction like a shark in Long Island to, like, wake everybody up, right? So tapping into both mythical and real fears regarding great white sharks, including an infamous set of shark attacks along the Jersey Shore in 1916, the 1974 novel became a bestseller, and the book was a key part of Universal's marketing campaign, which began several months before the film's release. So this was all part of the same shebang. So starting in the fall of 1974, Zanuck, Brown, and Benchley appeared on a number of radio and television programs to promote the release simultaneously of the paperback edition of the novel and the upcoming film. The marketing also included a national television advertising campaign that featured emerging composer John Williams' two-note theme. Mm-hmm. And the plan was for a summer release, which at the time was reserved for films with less than stellar reviews. And that's because films at the time typically were released market by market, preceded by local reviews. But Universal's decision to release the film in hundreds of theaters across the country on the same day, well, that led to huge upfront profits, sparking a 14-week run as the number one film in the U.S. and really affecting all movie releases afterwards, right?
Mm-hmm.
It catapulted Spielberg to fame. It kicked off the director's long collaboration with Williams, who would go on to earn the second highest number of Academy Award nominations in history, a total of 54.
Wow.
Yeah, second only to, any guesses?
Liza Minnelli.
It's Walt Disney, who has 59.
Oh,
amazing, right?
Okay.
So even though the theme song is now considered one of the greatest scores in film history, when Williams first proposed the two-note theme to Spielberg, Spielberg thought he was joking. But Williams had been inspired by 19th and 20th century composers like Claude Debussy, Igor Stravinsky, and especially Dvorak's Symphony No. 9.
Mm.
Also, especially Gustav Holst. If you ever listen to The Planets,
yep.
you will hear Star Wars.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. The classics are full of John Williams' inspiration. Also, Peter and the Wolf. There are some of the Sergei Prokofiev's little hints in there, too. And getting more specific into the musicality of it here, the varying pace of what's called the ostinato, which is a musical motif that repeats itself, it elicits intensifying degrees of emotion and fear. And this became even more important as Spielberg and the technical team found themselves struggling with the malfunctioning pneumatic shark that they had nicknamed Bruce after Spielberg's lawyer. So that's why the shark does not appear until the 81-minute mark of a 124-minute film. But the presence is felt because of the theme, which some music scholars have theorized even might evoke a shark's heartbeat.
I mean, okay, that's fine. I'll accept that, but I
yeah, they needed to fill some chapters in a book.
A little artistic license there, right? Now, Williams also has Disney to thank for revolutionizing character-driven music and film. Both of them understood how music can heighten emotion and magnify action for audiences. So even though Disney's career started in the silent film era, he became a titan of film and later media by leveraging sound to establish one of the greatest stars in media history. We're talking, of course, about Mickey Mouse. So when Disney saw in 1927 the jazz singer, the first talkie, he knew from that experience that sound was going to be the future of film. A year later, in 1928, Steamboat Willie premiered at Universal's Colony Theater in New York City as Disney's first animated film to incorporate synchronized sound. Now, unlike previous attempts to bring sound into film by having record players concurrently play or deploying live musicians to perform in the theater, Disney used technology that recorded sound directly on the film reel. Basically, the fidelity was a little bit better, right?
Well, it's more the syncing of those devices. The record player you were talking about, it just skipped all the time. So you get like 20 minutes in before the Vitaphone was just like, and done.
Or if you've got the live people playing and they miss a cue or something, it just totally ruins the whole suspension of disbelief, right? So that's why for a long time, the use of music or sound that matches the rhythm of characters on screen, it became known as, quote, Mickey Mousing. For example, King Kong in 1933 would deploy Mickey Mousing in a live action film. For example, in one scene, Kong carries away Ann Darrow, who's played by Faye Ray. Composer Max Steiner uses lighter tones to convey Kong's curiosity as he holds her, but then follows it with ominous, faster tones as she escapes and he chases after her. Now, Mickey Mousing declined in popularity after World War II because many filmmakers saw it as juvenile and too simplistic for what was now becoming an evolving and advancing film industry. But we still saw the technique in some iconic scenes, like the playing of violins in the shower in Psycho, right? And Spielberg, he idolized Hitchcock. Young Spielberg was even kicked off the Universal lot after sneaking on to watch the production of Hitchcock's 1966 film Torn Curtain. And Jaws clearly exhibits Hitchcockian influence. And that might be why Spielberg initially overcame his doubts about using such a simple theme to represent tension in the thriller.
Yeah, well, it's that whole Peter and the Wolf thing of each little musical tune genuinely is meant to represent that character, as opposed to just here's some exciting music, here's some sad music. It's like, no, this music is this guy. And all you have to do is hear the music and you know the guy is in the scene, even if you don't see him.
It's the Shaft theme song.
Another great example.
Well, hopefully we'll see more. Next link.
Next link. We're going to stay related to animals and music. A new study knocks down a popular hypothesis about why birds sing at dawn.
Okay, I didn't have a hypothesis about that, so I'm eager to hear.
yeah, me neither. I just kind of assumed they were happy to get their day started, you know?
Right. Oh no, they're horny and lonely.
Yeah, and the reasons after they discussed it, I was like, oh, I mean, they were untested hypotheses. So this actually finally tested them and found that the hypotheses were probably at least not comprehensive or universal. So for decades, a dominant theory about why birds sing at dawn, called the dawn chorus, has been that they can be heard further and more clearly at that time. Sound travels faster in humid air, and it's more humid early in the morning. It's less windy, too, which is thought to lessen any distortion of their vocalizations. The study, called Why is the Early Bird Early? An Evaluation of Hypotheses for Avian Dawn-Biased Vocal Activity, was published this month in the peer-reviewed journal Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society B.
I love how overwrought that had to be. When I know, like, right? Why do the birds sing in the morning?
Yeah. And like, you know, they put a pun in, so they're like, all right, the second half has to be really serious.
Right.
So the researchers didn't definitively point to one reason for why the dawn course is happening, but they found support for ideas that the early morning racket relates to birds marking their territory after being inactive at night and communicating about finding food. The team analyzed recordings from audio recorders placed at 43 locations in the Western Ghats mountain range in southern India. They examined sounds of what they determined were 69 different species of birds and studied recordings from the hours around dawn and the hours around dusk to compare activity. In order to evaluate the acoustic transmission hypothesis, they first had to make a prediction that birds that vocalize at higher frequencies would be more active at dawn than at dusk. They predicted this because they said higher frequencies are more susceptible to degradation due to environmental factors such as wind and humidity. But they found no significant relationship between the peak frequency of vocalizations and a type of bird's preference for making noise at dawn instead of dusk. So the relationships they did spotlight were that birds were more territorial and those with an omnivorous diet were more vocal at dawn rather than dusk. They speculate that a reason that omnivorous birds have a marginally higher level of vocal activity at dawn is because they often participate in flock hunting parties that more often happen at dawn. But as to why those hunting parties happen at dawn to begin with, they aren't sure. As the researchers note, there are plenty of caveats. They only studied birds in one particular tropical region in India. They also didn't observe the birds visually and didn't record exactly when dawn and dusk started. They just used approximate times. Steve Nowicki, a professor of biology at Duke University who's studied birdsong but was not involved in the study, says, "Sometimes there are phenomena where there's not a single causal reason, and that's kind of frustrating to scientists."
Yeah, but also expecting a silver bullet is kind of on you, science.
Yeah, and we all know how much scientists love to button things up, you know.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who has literally left my house and gone out in the backyard to throw a rock aimlessly at a tree to get a bird to go away at the crack of dawn.
Yeah.
I couldn't see the bird. There was no way I was going to hit it. I just wanted it to leave, and it did, so it was fine.
Yeah, and like, on the flip side, being downtown in Austin around like 7 p.m. when the birds start to go crazy, like, that is a wild experience.
Well, part of that has to be due to the fact that Austin pipes out bird distress sounds to discourage nesting. So, I mean, the whole thing is just like an apocalyptic war zone for them anyway.
Right. Wow. We're screaming at them.
Have you tried asking them? Next time, Jennifer, like, hey, can you just go to another tree?
Yeah, if I'd ask nicely, maybe he would have moved. I don't know.
I mean, try it.
Excuse me, sir.
Or you could just start doing your own bird call to just annoy them, like, really badly, like, tweedledee.
That's a great way to get in with the neighbors. They'll love me.
You know? You never know.
Next link.
Next link.
We'll stay with sound, but a little bit more disappointing. This is from El País. Fake bands and artificial songs are taking over YouTube and Spotify.
Yeah.
But are they any good? Like, are people actually jamming to this? Or are they just rolling their eye and... Aww. Mm-hmm.
So, the description of the album Rumba Congo, uploaded to YouTube, tells the entire story of the musicians that recorded it. The band is called Concubanas, founded in Havana in 1971. The group played a unique fusion of Cuban and Congolese music. They disbanded in 1992, but not before leaving behind countless musical gems. At the very bottom of the description beneath the YouTube video, there's a note that the content is, quote, altered or synthetic. This phrase is a euphemism to indicate that music in the video was generated using AI. The band is not real.
Wow.
Platforms such as, I don't even know if I want to give these names away. But Suno, Boomy, Udio allow for the generation of relatively intricate jazz or rock compositions. They actually have a YouTube link to it, which I refuse to click on to give them more views. A study by the International Confederation of Societies of Authors and Composers, or CISAC, in France estimates that Revenue from AI-generated music will increase from $100 million in 2023, which is way too much, to around $4 billion in 2028. I think that's also way too much. By then, the organization estimates that 20% of streaming platforms' revenue will come from this type of music. One of the major problems with the trend is the lack of transparency. On the Spotify community, a forum for service users, a petition is circulating that calls for a clear labeling of AI-generated music, as well as the option for users to block these types of songs from appearing on their feeds. Good luck with that petition, y'all.
Yeah.
The feelings of deception or betrayal that listeners may experience are pretty bad, but this is a personal experience, right? There's some that will feel that this is terrible, and others who will admire the technology. Some take it as a joke, deploying the classic sarcasm of internet trolls. So one of the comments was, I remember this band playing live when I ran into a CIA agent in Havana Cafe in 1972. What a time. And then somebody else replied, I was that CIA agent. And then this is where it gets sad and where we have to be cautious, because either believing the conversation or perhaps simply continuing the thread, somebody says, it's incredible that you two met here on YouTube again.
Okay.
Which may or may not be a joke. It's tough to tell.
Or an AI response. Like,
right. Yeah. The key is it funny? Do you still want to engage? Like, once you have heard and know, what action are you going to take afterwards?
Well, I think the answer to that is very clearly in the fact that they had to put this backstory in the description because people want the backstory. And I do think that the trend is going to swing back to where live music is the thing that people want to see, because you want to watch a person with skill, not just hear some notes that sound good together.
Some do. Some just want to, like, I know people who listen to podcasts, not for the content, but just for the ASMR of it.
Ugh, well, that's a whole, I hate ASMR, so I'm not a good.
Yeah, me too. We're all in that camp.
I find it really horrifying. Like, oh,
right,
God.
But that's still a subjective preference. And that's what we're kind of coming into with a lot of this AI creativity is like, is this actually going to resonate with anyone at a level that art should resonate at?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you know, this Roomba Congo, it's not the only fictional band out there, right? There's a band called Fantasia with a PH. Distills a fusion of flutes, electronic sounds. And to your point, they even have an invented past. It says, after Ryo Kobayashi's departure in 1976, Fantasia entered a period of silence. 2 years later, the group reformed for whatever, right?
Yeah, it's all made up. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. It's all BS, yeah.
I like that they used Kobayashi in there as like a total giveaway that this was fabricated.
Yeah, that site, both fake bands originate from the same channel. They've published 135 music videos in 7 months.
Jeez.
And the channel has accumulated millions of views and 37,000 subscribers. Like, please, y'all stop.
Mm-hmm.
And on that note, next link.
Next link.
All right. Next up, we have a lovely profile from The Guardian about an American woman who flew fighter planes for Britain during World War II and who just turned 106 years old.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yeah. So happy birthday to Nancy Miller Stratford, who is one of several pilots featured in a new book called Spitfires, which specifically highlights American women who at the time weren't allowed to fly planes for the U.S. military. So they went to the U.K. to do it anyway. So Stratford was born in Los Angeles in 1919, but her first experience in a plane wasn't until her 16th birthday, when her parents got her a short trip in a little private plane for a birthday present. And she said that first flight was actually fairly boring, right up until the end, when the pilot struggled with the landing. They unexpectedly dropped several thousand feet in altitude, which left her brother absolutely terrified, but made Stratford give out a whoop of joy. And from that moment, she was hooked. A few years later, in college, she learned about an opportunity for civilian pilot training that would accept women. And while her father was against it, he eventually signed the permission slip for his adult daughter to take the classes. Which, in case my tone wasn't clear, it sucked to be a woman in the 40s. Anyway, by this point, World War II had started. And as soon as she was certified, Stratford announced that she was going overseas to join the UK's Air Transport Auxiliary, which was technically a civilian operation, but which was allowed to help in the war effort in certain specific ways, none of which were available to her in the US. And her fiance at the time actually tried to forbid her from going. So she broke up with him and went anyway.
Yay!
Nice.
Yeah. So the women who flew for the ATA were affectionately known as Attagirls, which is adorable.
No.
And what they would do is fly brand new, sometimes untested bombers and fighter planes from the factories to the appropriate military base and then fly back in damaged planes that were being sent in for repair.
Whoa!
So while they were never technically in a combat zone, the job was definitely hazardous. And yeah. It's estimated that about 1 out of 7 Attagirls did die due to their planes malfunctioning mid-flight.
Wow.
On the other hand, the article notes, Stratford was quite possibly safer flying damaged British planes than she would have been flying commercially in the U.S., because at that time, the discrimination against female pilots was so rampant that male pilots in the U.S. would deliberately sabotage the female pilots' planes, usually by pouring sugar into the gas tank or even by slashing their tires.
Oof.
Fortunately, Stratford was smart enough to get away from all that, and even better, she didn't die in the war effort. She says her most memorable delivery was a Spitfire plane to a Polish squadron just days before that squadron participated in D-Day. After the war, she had to come back to the U.S., and she took the only flying job she could get, which was piloting a crop-dusting plane in Oregon. Unfortunately, societal change is slow, and passenger airlines wouldn't start hiring women for another 25 years. Basically, it happened in the 1970s. So rather than wait around, Stratford broke barriers again when she became the second woman ever in the U.S. to earn her commercial helicopter license.
Mm.
She then found a husband who supported her career, and they moved to Alaska to run a helicopter business that would fly tourists up to the mountain peaks, as well as transporting construction workers to the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
Hmm.
By the time she retired, Stratford had flown more than 103 different aircraft.
That's insane.
And while the numbers still aren't great for female pilots today, they hover around 5% in both the U.S. and the U.K., Stratford says she's happy to have done her part. Quote, I was glad that I could help out. I think my mother thought I should get married or something, but I didn't feel that way. As for living to 106, her advice changes from day to day. Sometimes she says the secret is not drinking too much, but other times she'll whisper that the real key is chocolate and vodka tonics. So happy birthday to a very cool and very old lady.
Yay!
This is not entirely related, but have y'all seen season 2 of The Rehearsal? Because, oh
no.
My God.
No.
Oh, you have to. It's Nathan Fielder.
Oh, that's with the Boeing and he flies, right?
Yes. So it's all about pilots. And it's specifically about this idea that a lot of modern pilot crashes only happen because the co-pilot is too scared to speak up because
Absolutely.
There is this bro culture among pilots.
Fly and, boys. What are you talking
yes.
about?
So he talks to some female pilots, and also obviously it's very funny. There's some horrific stuff in there too. I mean, it's Nathan Fielder. Like, you got to yeah. go in knowing that it's not fully yeah. straightforward.
That's so great.
Next link.
Next link.
All right, we're going to go to Cosmos Magazine and take a look at how front-facing brake lights could significantly prevent road crashes.
Oh, okay.
Huh.
It would be a relatively simple addition to your car, an extra brake light on the front. But what if that could prevent thousands of collisions? That's the question behind a new study led by Ernst Tamasch, a road safety expert in Austria. The team analyzed real-world crash data and accident reconstructions to test the idea, and the results are... They chose the word striking. Okay. Well, listen, the study suggests that adding a forward-facing brake light could cut collisions by up to a fifth.
It does kind of make sense, because it's not so much that, like, oh, you see the light and you know they're braking. It's that if brake lights on the front are standard and you don't see them, you know that guy is barreling towards you and is not yeah. going to slow down and you can't turn across, right?
It's mm-hmm. just more information about what they're doing in a way that is visible, not just behind the car, but in front as well.
Yeah. I mean, on the flip side, I've always thought that we should also have acceleration lights on the backs of cars, personally, so I know when other cars are speeding up. But, you know, that's just me. I don't know. Maybe that's too crazy.
They should totally do like a little like Batmobile flame hologram for that. How rad would that be? But, you know, they could only have a positive effect if other road users can actually see them. Now, this was not the case in about a third of the reconstructed accidents due to unfavorable angles or the vehicles involved. So the recommendation is to fit brake lights to the sides of the vehicles as well.
That's fine. Like, I think there should be more indicators of everything. I drove a car once, and this is kind of more standard now, but this was back in the 90s. When you turn the turn signal on, a little itty bitty headlight turned on toward the left. so you could see where you were turning.
Oh.
And it was such a simple little thing, and it was wonderful. It changed everything when you're driving at night.
Yeah.
And anyway, but little stuff like that, I think, makes such a difference when you're talking about cars mm-hmm. and people dying.
And I like that you mentioned that this was like contextual, because I could also see driving disco balls as hazardous for drivers.
Right. Too much is too much.
Exactly.
Yeah,
sure. But when it's contextual, like I have the turn signal and we're going left, let's move the light that way. Why not? Smart cars. Smart cars. Smarter cars.
Smarter people? Just aww. Can we get for it?
Okay, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from CNN.com. It's titled First Methane Powered Sea Spiders Found Crawling on the Ocean Floor.
Oh, good. Little kaiju baby.
Yeah.
I'm assuming this is biologically powered, not like we've made robots powered by methane, right?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Biological sea spiders.
Okay. Which is, you know, also horrifying, yeah. but in a different way.
So heat trapping methane may be best known for the dangers it poses to humans and Earth's atmosphere, but in the dark depths of the ocean, the greenhouse gas is a nourishing meal for some of the world's most mysterious creatures, according to new research. Scientists say they have discovered three previously unknown, unnamed species of sea spider that could be teaming up with bacteria to thrive off gas bubbling from the sea floor in sparsely studied marine habitats known as methane seeps. In this symbiotic relationship, bacteria take up real estate on the spider's exoskeletons, and in return, the microbes convert carbon-rich methane and oxygen into sugars and fats the spiders can eat. Shauna Goffredi, a professor and chair of biology at Occidental College in Los Angeles and the study's principal investigator, says, "Just like you would eat eggs for breakfast, the sea spider grazes the surface of its body, and it munches all those bacteria for nutrition." Other species of sea spiders share more in common with their terrestrial cousins, using large tube-like fangs to capture, immobilize, and suck the fluids from soft-bodied prey, such as jellyfish. But lab observations of the newfound species reveal they lack the necessary appendages to capture prey, making them more akin to farmers harvesting methane-fueled bacteria from their own bodies.
Oh!
Yeah, pretty strange. It's possible the spiders and their hitchhiking microbes play a crucial role in preventing methane, a natural gas thought to exacerbate global warming, from reaching Earth's atmosphere, according to Goffredi. Light from the sun doesn't reach the deep sea ecosystem where the newly described Cerecosura spider species make their home. To survive in this dark environment, microbes evolved to use chemicals instead of sunlight for energy, explained marine biologist Nicole Dublier. She was not involved in the study, but she explains, after marine life dies, it sinks to the seafloor and becomes buried. In the process of decomposition, methane gas is released, escaping through the cracks of sediment as bubbles. Instead of floating away with the whims of the water column, the microbes that feed on the methane attach themselves to sea animals to remain among the bubbles. By analyzing isotopes in the spider's tissues, the scientists determined the bacteria weren't just hitching a ride from an eight-legged friend, they were also being eaten. Dublier said, "This is really the beauty of the symbiosis between the two. The bacteria get that perfect Goldilocks zone with everything they need. Even if 80% of the population are eaten by the spiders, it's worth it for the 20% to keep surviving and reproducing."
Hmm.
So, since the spiders are so small, many of their organs are found inside of their appendages. To mate, the female spiders shoot hundreds of eggs from their kneecaps, which
whoa.
The males... Yeah. Not the place you'd expect.
Well, you know, for some people, the kneecap is an erogenous zone. You know.
Yeah. Very true. And for some species.
Right. So if you need somebody in the groin, you might actually be making a really loving move, right?
Wow. Yeah. And the male spiders collect those eggs into sack-like bundles looped around their legs like bracelets.
Aww.
And yeah, there is a photo of this, I believe. I mean, at this scale, it looks like caviar, you know, but it's spider eggs. It's not caviar.
No.
And they're in these little like bubble sacks that are just like looped around the spider.
They're blinged out.
Yeah, yeah. They've got egg bling.
This needs to catch on among humans, like larger sizes, obviously, but we need jewelry that's eggs.
Egg bling is ready to trademark.
Got my quail egg bracelet ready to go. And
yeah, exactly. Like that's the right size. Exactly.
So once the eggs hatched, Goffredi's team noticed bacteria living on the father spiders attached itself to the hatchlings, providing them with an early source of food as well.
Mm.
So studying microbiome inheritance in animals could potentially help scientists understand more about humans' gut bacteria, for example, is passed between mothers and newborn children. Further exploration of the seafloor could also uncover additional similar sea spider species. Goffredi said, "People tend to think of the deep sea as a kind of homogeneous ecosystem, but that's actually untrue. There's a lot of biodiversity by region, and animals are very localized to specific habitats on the seafloor. You have to be very careful if you decide to use the seafloor for mining, for example. We don't want to cause any kind of irreparable harm to very specific habitats that aren't found anywhere else."
Oh, we will.
Yeah. I mean, that seems inevitable. But it's like now when all the methane suddenly starts rising up to the surface, we could be like, oh, we know why. Okay, cool.
Yeah, we killed all the spiders. Dang.
Yeah. We'll have a complete understanding of our decimation as opposed to going, why? We don't know.
Yes. That's the important part.
Right.
Next link.
Next link.
This comes from the Smithsonian Magazine. The way you breathe is unique to you, like a fingerprint.
Mm.
A new study published in the journal Current Biology last week found that people can be reliably identified by their breathing pattern alone. And these patterns seem to be correlated with indicators of physical and mental health. As we know, breathing is regulated by the brain. Each inhale and exhale you take triggers electrical activity in neurons. According to Noam Sobol, we've hypothesized brains are unique, ergo, breathing patterns would be also unique. He is a neurobiologist at the Weizmann Institute of Science, which is why he was obligated to use the term ergo. To test this hypothesis, Sobel and his team developed a wearable device that tracks nasal airflow over 24 hours, recording details like the duration of each breath, time between breaths, and the amount of air passing through each nostril. The study's 100 participants wore the device while going about their daily routines and logging their activities in an app. This is where it gets crazy. The scientists were able to identify the participants based on their breathing patterns with 96.8% accuracy using a machine learning program. Mm. And that level of accuracy was consistent across retests spanning 2 years, which also allowed the researchers to further train their algorithm. Your breath could also tell people other things about you. The researchers found that certain breathing patterns correlated with other traits, such as body mass index and levels of depression and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
People who scored higher on anxiety questionnaires, for instance, had shorter inhales and more varied pulses in deep breath during sleep. Those with higher depression scores tended to exhale more quickly. So for someone like me, who is high anxiety and high depression,
right.
Some research notes that further work should test more people.
Right. You got to get those outliers to really get your data complete. Mm-hmm. I like that it basically seems to be over the a longer period of time, because my breathing obviously changes throughout the day depending on what's going on. But you can get that average, I guess, and that makes it more reliable.
Right. Because they do mention here at the end, 10 minutes is not enough. You need 24 hours. And, honestly, I think you would need more than that, because for me, I may be having a bad day.
Right. Or a bad week. You could absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think over the course of, a week or 2 weeks, you'd get a sense of that. But what the team is really focusing on, too, is it could be a diagnostics tool for a person's mental or physical state.
Right. That's true. Because you can at least be like, well, you're anxious now. We don't know if you're generally an anxious person, but we can definitely say at this moment you are feeling anxious.
Right. And maybe it's because you're anxious and depressed, it changes the way you breathe, or because of the way you breathe makes you depressed. So they're working on understanding whether mimicking healthy breathing patterns can help people improve their well-being. And I think yoga and meditation has proved that that's true.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We've done tons of studies on this where, alternate nostril breathing is especially effective for reducing anxiety. So I don't know, maybe a joint project, y'all?
Right. Combining the two, being able to pattern that on your phone. I'm sure somebody will make an app behind a paywall. But that's it. AI is doing everything now, right? It can even tell your breathing pattern over the course of a day.
I mean, we just had that article about they can tell who you are from your face print. They can tell who you are from your voice print. You might as well just add breathing to that. Give up. There's just no point in trying to resist anymore.
Right.
It's fine. Or don't breathe. Those are your options.
Right.
Or we breathe like the way in Dune that they walk across the sand. So it's like
there you go.
Extremely hard to tell what we're doing because we're like.
I'm sure that
all
won't...
protests are just this horrible gasping mob now.
I'm saying.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include The Bangkok Death Cafe That Changed My Life, The Solar System's Greatest Mystery May Finally Be Solved, and Scientists Reveal a Surprising Link Between Depression and Microbes in Your Mouth. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteresting Week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.